Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Today, we are going to be talking about something that was really, really requested. Actually, a lot of you all requested an episode on eating disorders and body image, and that's something that Kibby and I don't have expertise in ourselves. And so we have invited a fabulous guest on who Kibby will introduce in just a second. But we are really grateful to have her on, and she's going to answer all the burning questions. So Kibby, take it away.
So this is my really good friend, Nandini Datta. She's a clinical psychologist, a postdoc fellow at Stanford, doing full-time research studying eating disorders. And her main specialty is understanding anorexia, especially in adolescents. So Nandini is fabulous. She was in our program. She was one of my really good friends when we were in grad school. And now she's off in California doing bigger and better things. So we really miss her. But I'm so glad that we get you for this episode. Is just an excuse just to talk to you about what you do, which is really cool.
No, thank you for having me. I'm super excited to be a part of this.
Great. And so can you explain to everyone like what exactly you study, or kind of give us a little bit more about what your particular interests are? And
yeah, absolutely. So I, from a research perspective, I'm really interested in looking at things that contribute to symptom development and eating disorders, specifically a newer eating disorder called ARFID, which stands for Avoidant Restrictive Food Intake Disorder. So that's a mouthful. So we call it ARFID, but it's like picky eating that onsets in early childhood. So the research project that I'm doing right now through a research grant that's at Stanford is looking at interoception, or the ability for teenagers to detect kind of what their internal body signals are telling them. So signals of hunger and fullness and things like that. Does that look different in a typically developing adolescent versus an adolescent with anorexia versus an adolescent with ARFID? So I'm currently undergoing data collection for that. But prior to doing this research grant, I was a clinician on a lot of my PI Jim Locke's research studies, administering family-based treatment to adolescents with anorexia nervosa. And I also am doing a psychosocial intervention for kids with ARFID, and continue to do that just because I love working with little kids, even while on this grant. So that's kind of what I've been up to in the past year and a half.
That's awesome. Oh, that's what you've been doing since you've been away from us. that's really cool, especially because I've been hearing that word ARFID more and more lately, and I just didn't understand if that was what that was. It was an eating disorder or something else. So can you start out by telling us a little bit about, I mean, a lot of people probably have questions about like body image and when is it normal, like insecurity, part of our culture, or when is it an eating disorder? And like, what are the eating disorders? Like, what is anorexia versus bulimia versus ARFID? Can you give us a little bit of an overview of all that?
Yeah, absolutely. So anorexia and ARFID both usually come with restrictive eating. So eating less than what your body needs based on how much energy you're expending throughout the day, oftentimes accompanied by weight loss, but not always. The big difference between ARFID and anorexia is that in anorexia, these eating differences or disturbances are driven by shape and weight concerns. So wanting to look a certain way, feeling like you look too big and wanting to lose weight. Whereas in ARFID, there's a complete absence of shape and weight concerns. So you typically see this in younger kids, and you typically see this in kids that have comorbid anxiety, sometimes comorbid autism. ARFID's interesting because it's really heterogeneous. And by that, I mean, it comes in three different subtypes, although some kids definitely have more than one subtype. But it's either like, this is a kid who has always had a low appetite, never really been interested in food, maybe was meeting failure to thrive as an infant, and has been like pervasively low weight. Or there's a subtype where, and you see this more in maybe kids with autism, where there's a lot of food sensory sensitivity. So like, I don't want slimy foods, or I don't want foods that are hard and things like that. And then the last subtype is fear of aversive consequences. So this has a much more acute sudden onset, but this is a kid who like maybe ate something and got sick and threw up, but then after that has really restricted their intake and dropped a ton of weight suddenly. And these are all different kinds of pictures of and glimpses of what ARFID can look like. And sometimes you have overlapping presentations. Whereas in anorexia, onset is usually more in adolescence, and the restrictive eating is driven by a desire to lose weight, to change one's body shape or weight. And, you know, we don't really know for sure what causes eating disorders. I get asked that question a lot. There is kind of a growing consensus that there is a range of biological, psychosocial, sociocultural factors that contribute to the illness presentation. But we're not totally sure why one adolescent develops anorexia versus another one. And I can speak more about that, too. And then other eating disorder, there's a whole bunch of other eating disorder diagnoses. My expertise lies more in ARFID and anorexia, but bulimia nervosa, for example, is, you know, body shape and weight concerns. And there's also some sort of purging going on. So that could be, you know, abusing laxatives. It could be making yourself throw up, different kinds of compensatory behaviors. And there's also usually the presence of eating with a loss of control. And loss of control is described as like feeling like you can't stop eating once you've started. Or when you describe it to kids, like if you imagine a ball rolling down a hill and it's like getting faster and faster. Have you ever felt like that when you're eating? Usually when you're having a large, objectively large amount of food. Although sometimes people explain feeling like this loss of control when they have a small amount of food too. But these are all kind of descriptions of binge episodes that you see in bulimia that's not necessarily there typically in anorexia.
Gotcha. So if someone is restricting their food, like not eating a lot, and then when they do, they exercise a lot, you know, like the compensatory behavior of like exercising like 2-3 hours a day or something like that, is that considered bulimia or is that considered anorexia?
It depends on, so that would depend on, I think weight would be one marker. So if they're also at a low weight, like they're at a negative energy imbalance, which means that the amount they're expending is more than how much they're taking in and they're at a low weight, that would be more of a anorexia presentation.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Do you get binging episodes in anorexia ever, or is it that's just purely restrictive?
I think when I used to work in the inpatient unit at Stanford for kids, for adolescents who have like medical instabilities based on low weight and the consequences of malnutrition that way, a lot of times they would describe what they think feels like a binge, but it's really just somebody being super hungry and eating a normal amount of food. But because of the illness and the nature of anorexia, to them it feels like, oh my gosh, that was a binge, but they really just had like a regular sized dinner.
Are there differences between are there different characteristics between people with anorexia versus bulimia, for instance? I mean, I remember reading that people with anorexia are much more likely to be highly perfectionistic. It's maybe different forms of anxiety or characteristics.
Right. And I can speak with confidence to anorexia. I know a little bit less about bulimia, but I remember that I think for kids with anorexia, like the things that make them to their parents, like such a good student, they're so driven, they get straight A's, like they never break any rules, they're always the good child. These are the kinds of things that I feel like anorexia co-opts and uses for evil, so to speak. And so like, they're the kid that's like, oh, I want to do well, I'm going to go all in, I'm going to study super hard. Same type of kid where, you know, initially maybe wants to eat a little bit healthier, be a little bit more active. I think especially in the beginning of the pandemic, we saw a lot of this. But they go all in and suddenly they're not in the driver's seat making decisions about their eating and exercise, and the eating disorder is. And so oftentimes when I talk to kids and parents about, you know, when the illness started, it's not when they decided to eat a little bit healthier, and it's not usually when they started to exercise a little bit. It's a couple weeks, months down the road when they suddenly felt like they weren't in control anymore and these decisions were occurring in the context of anorexia. So that perfectionistic, really driven to do something, going all in, is oftentimes something that we see in these kids.
Mm-hmm. And that's interesting too, the idea that it could start out, you know, with just, I want to get healthier, and then suddenly, you know, it kind of progresses to a problem. For people who are listening who have like loved ones, like family members or friends or kids with some of these behaviors, how can you tell, like maybe this, how do you assess this? How do you assess if someone is trying to get on one of those like fad diets or just trying to lose some weight and exercise really intensely versus like, oh, there's an eating disorder.
Right. I think it's super tricky. And I think one thing that's important to understand about anorexia that I think makes it different than something like depression or anxiety, and also difficult to treat is that it's what we call egosyntonic, which means that for the person that has this illness, it feels good. Like the person with the illness wants to protect it. Whereas like somebody with depression or anxiety might want to seek out treatment. Like it feels crummy. They don't want this anymore. They don't want to feel depressed or super anxious. But the person with anorexia, actually, like it feels good to them. They don't want to get rid of it. So it's often they feel like they really resist treatment, which is why one of the treatments that has a lot of evidence backing it, family-based treatment, created by Jim Locke, who is my boss at Stanford, and Daniel LaGrange, who's at UCSF, is a really good treatment because it puts the parents in control for the first several weeks until the kid is able to slowly start taking control of their eating again. And it's because, you know, the kid doesn't want to chew. The kid doesn't want to eat more. And so parents really need to be in charge in the beginning there and help support their adolescent in recovery. And there's less research about what is effective for adults that develop anorexia. But I know that some folks at Stanford had been looking about how partners can support them in similar ways. I don't know if I answered your question. I think your question was something a little different.
I'm just curious if, you know, even people who are listening are probably like, well, they might be noticing that their kid or their partner
right,
or whatever
right.
is restricting or doing something, but they're not sure when this becomes a problem. I mean, we talked about this
right.
in different contexts of like a lot of people started drinking more in the pandemic. And then we've gotten
yeah.
questions of like, when do we know this is an issue? When did someone seek treatment? When is this a disorder versus just like, this is a crazy year and
totally.
Right? or someone going through some change where they want to lose weight. Like, how do we know?
Yeah. And I feel like, and I could be biased because a lot of this is coming from my own anecdotal experience of having worked on the inpatient unit. And so I see a lot of kids that are like seriously ill, like the vital signs are really wonky in the context of their eating disorder. But a lot of kids, the phrase like since shelter in place, like X, Y, and Z happened. And a lot of parents put a lot of blame on themselves. Like, oh my gosh, like, you know, it was a pandemic and they wanted to get out and exercise more and eat healthier. I wish I had caught it earlier. I wish I had done this. It's my fault. One of the really important things that we try to convey to parents of kids with eating disorders, like, it's not your fault. It's not your kid's fault. It's not your fault. It's not because of something that someone said or didn't say or do or didn't do that they developed this illness. We know that it's kind of like a range of things. But what's really important is that we react now and treat it aggressively. There's often a comparison to anorexia and cancer because they're both aggressive, life-threatening illnesses that can, you know, prematurely kill someone. And we don't know what causes either of them. We don't know why somebody develops cancer necessarily. But the treatments are aggressive, might not feel good for the person receiving the treatment, but is super effective. And we know we can help people with the treatments that are out there. And it usually requires a lot of support for both cancer and anorexia from external family, peers, friends, all those kinds of things.
So I know you're saying it's not the family's fault. And I, you know, I think that goes with so many of these disorders, even when we say that with like BPD, you know, it's not like you can just blame the parents. And yet there is a big component of how kids are raised and then whether they develop BPD later on. Is there, I mean, have you seen patterns between like how parents talk to their kids and then how likely they are to later develop these symptoms, or is there no link there?
I don't know of any link there. That does not mean that it doesn't exist. It could be that I just don't know about it. But I can see the rationale for why that might be so. I would imagine that there are certain ways of talking to your teenager that are probably more harmful than helpful. But I don't know of any like link in the literature currently that then later then predicts the development of an eating disorder.
Okay.
Can you give us, let's say, a picture of what maybe like behaviors or like clinical examples of what it looks like when someone is like very severe in the inpatient unit versus like starting or, you know, they're not sure that they had any disorder, but really didn't, you know, can you give us like a kind of a picture of what, you know, different clinical profiles can look like or?
Yeah. Yeah. So I feel like for someone who's really, really entrenched, like really sick, has been sick for a long time, hasn't gotten a treatment, hasn't really started to feel better and do things to like engage in treatment and things like that. It's scary. There's a, for adults, there's a like, it's not an official diagnosis, but it's referred to in research as severe and enduring anorexia. And there's specific, and it's, I'm going to try to remember most of them, but it's like they've gone through like two different evidence-based treatments for anorexia and haven't made progress. They have been sick, like their illness duration is greater than 3 years, I think is what it is. And some other markers, I think, weight and other things that make somebody have severe and enduring anorexia, and it's seen in adults. And it's scary and it's sad. And I remember I went to a conference in when I was at Duke, where they were talking about the ethics of treating eating disorders and adults with eating disorders. And what do you do if somebody says, like, look, I am a 50-year-old woman. I just want to be at, you know, 60% of my ideal body weight. I know my vitals are like borderline there, but I can do it. I can eat enough to keep myself there. Will you be my clinician and help me stay at that weight? Like, what do you do? Like, would you take on that case to help them be there? Or is that unethical? Because you know that that's so scary and so dangerous. And it was just generating discussion around that. I work with adolescents, so I haven't had those kinds of conversations myself. But, you know, to get back to your question, I think that teens that are starting out with the illness, even if they're in the hospital, and it's the first time they've been there, families are really scared. And sometimes the teen is scared too. Like, they had no idea that their vital signs were going to be unstable and that their heart was at risk. They don't understand the medical consequences of malnutrition. And a lot of times that's like a wake up call, and then they get engaged in treatment. And it's so rewarding to see those families kind of like, they're learning, like they're going through psychoeducation. They're learning what their kid needs, what the body needs, how to renourish their kid and how to get their kid kind of back on their side. I think a lot of parents also, they haven't had to, these are the kids that like, they're the good kids. They haven't had to discipline their kids. And what anorexia can do, no matter what age you are, is sort of, we call them anorexic tantrums. It's like suddenly having a piece of pizza is the worst thing in the world. You can't imagine doing it. You want to cry, you want to throw a fit. And these parents are like, oh my God, like we've never had to like help scaffold our child around. Like, we've never seen these behaviors. And it's important to remind them, like, this is anorexia. This is not your kid. You have to have a mantra, like, just be firm, be patient. Like, food is going to be their medicine right now, and it needs to be non-negotiable. A little analogy I like to give parents is, like, if your kid woke up and said, because parents are often like, what if they don't want to have a bite? Like, what if they want to just, like, please, mom, can I just have half of my dinner? So I think about it this way. Like, what if your kid woke up and was like, may I have a shot of whiskey before I go to school? What would you say? And they're usually laugh and they're like, no, of course, like we wouldn't let our kid have a shot of whiskey. I'm like, okay, what if they're like, can I just have half a shot? Just half a shot. Would you be like, all right, fine, half a shot's fine, or no? And they're like, no, definitely not. And then I'm like, what if they just want a sip? Just a sip of whiskey, just a little nip before they go to school. It's like hard no, still hard no. So that's the kind of mentality that you want around meals. Like, meals need to be non-negotiable situations. They have to eat it. Like, if emotions are rising high and they're getting really dysregulated, wait for that to come back down, like, then get back to it. Like, they need to be eating. Otherwise, the consequences on their bone density, on their health, all of these things are so, so scary. And a lot of times parents and teenagers don't know that. They don't know that these are the kinds of things that are happening to their body on the inside if they're not eating enough. I don't know if that answered your question.
Yeah, I'm actually now curious that what anorexia looks like when you're watching eating behaviors and your kid or like loved one. Is it that they're not eating anything at all, or they're eating specific things, or they're eating in a structured way? Like, how can you, it just sometimes is way more different than I thought, which I thought it was like eating like nothing or only vegetables or something.
Right. There can be such a range. It could be like they've suddenly decided to go vegan or vegetarian. But it could be that they are cutting out like all sugars and all carbs. That's a common one. Or cutting out all fats, or not wanting to cook with olive oil, or not wanting to order out, or something that we see both during the development of anorexia and during the renourishment process is like micro bites. So like cutting the food into teeny tiny little pieces and having like tiny little bites, like prolonging the mealtime. All of these are strategies. Anorexia is very smart. Anorexia will use whatever strategy that it can to get out of eating. And so parents and loved ones and caregivers need to learn to just kind of outwit and outlast that disorder. So like really look out, like hiding food in your sleeves or cheeking the food or things like just making sure that you know all these tips and tricks. and that you are looking out for them and just kind of persevering, even if the meal is lasting a really long time, just sticking through it, knowing how important it is, knowing how important, like, every bite counts.
You know, I was just going to say, I have like a million questions about the treatment part of this and the role of the family and friends. I just want to make sure first, like, that we get a real picture of what this is like for the person with anorexia. Do you have kind of an illustration of, like, you're talking to a patient with anorexia, how would they say, like, what's the internal experience of getting from, okay, you know, I'm going to start exercise or go on this diet, I've got this goal, and then it gets really perfectionistic. And then, so how do they get from there to, like, terror at the thought of eating a slice of pizza? What's that like for them inside? What's that journey like?
Yeah. And, you know, I can answer by reflecting on sort of intakes that I've done with kids where it's like food stops losing the joy that it brought them. And like, suddenly it's all about, and they're miserable. They know they're miserable, but they don't know what to do to turn it around because the eating disorder feels really good. But it goes from like going on a diet and exercising moderately in a healthy way to like having just a routine around this, having this, like, it feels more like a compulsion. It feels more like you have to do this and you have to earn your food or you can't eat. And I think some of the anecdotal things that we've heard is like, it's terrifying to them to try to eat. And I think they realize this throughout the journey of like when it turns from just dieting and healthy eating to something a little bit more pathological, but they don't know what to do at that point other than just keep doing it. And then for those who don't ever seek treatment or don't have the support of their families and friends, like, anorexia is a very isolating illness. These adolescents and adults who describe having it, they're super lonely. There's a lot of blogs and things that promote pro-anorexia or pro-bulimia. And I had done a little bit of research on this during grad school, but not extensively. But what I remember seeing that was, like, I didn't know these existed was, like, there are a lot of blogs promoting that, like, Anna being anorexia and Mia being bulimia are the only friends you need. Like, these are the only friends you're ever going to need. So let's take care of our friends. And then all these diets and things like that. And it's scary. Like, it's all out there on the internet and, like, on Instagram and social media and things like that. It's honestly scary. But because it's such an isolating disease and the person with anorexia just gets more and more entrenched, it's why I think early treatment is so important to start to drive a wedge between that.
That's so interesting because we often talk about how mental health issues play into relationships, like what kind that it starts to change our social circle. It changes the way we relate to others. And we talk about how this, you know, this disorder would affect a relationship. And it sounds, yeah, the isolating part is interesting because it's like they're developing a relationship with the disorder.
Yep. Yep.
Huh. Exactly, and then what happens, yeah, in there? What happens in there? What's the typical? What does it look like if you are a parent of
I think
of someone
your kid, your kid is withdrawing. Like, your kid is starting to withdraw from, like, relationship with the family. Maybe they're snapping at their sibling more. When we do family based treatment, everyone's involved. The people who are going to be there at mealtime, so mom and dad, and siblings, even young siblings. We want everyone there. And in the first session, we go and ask everyone how anorexia has affected them. And in those sessions, I really learned, like, of course it's affecting the young person with the illness, right? Of course. But it really does impact everybody in the family so differently. Like, siblings are like, man, like, my sister's not fun anymore. Or, like, mealtimes are really, really stressful. I just don't want to eat with the family anymore. Parents are like, I'm so nervous when we have a meal or when we go grocery shopping, like, I don't know what to get. And a lot of times there's a lot of catering to the illness, like a lot of, well, I got all veggie stuff because I know at least she'll eat that. But similar to anxiety and how if you're avoiding things for reasons of anxiety, the anxiety gets worse. Similar here, like if you're just narrowing the diet more and more to cater to the anorexia is going to get worse, unfortunately. Mm. Yeah.
I often hear people, I think this is a common refrain. Like, I wanted to look different, lose weight, but I also wanted to control some element in my life. Like, I wanted control, and that's why I turned to this. And it's interesting because when you describe it, it really sounds more like a lack of control. So, you know, controlling in the beginning, but then the train is kind of goes off on its own and you're no longer in charge of it. Is that right? Or what's that like for them?
Yeah, I think that's such a good point and reflection is like, you're right. A lot of these, especially these like since shelter in place kids, right, who the world is spinning out of our control, they're not going to school anymore, to have some semblance of control, like, okay, I'm gonna like build into my schedule some activity, I'm gonna cut out sweets, things like that, like feels like you're having more control for sure. Initially is like I'm exerting control over something I can't exert control over, which is like my eating. But then it starts to spin out of control where they're suddenly realizing they're not in the driver's seat anymore and there's nothing they can do about it. I think it is a switch from being apparently in control to the eating disorder being in control. But the problem with the illness being so egocentric is like they still think they're in control. You know, they still feel like they're in the driver's seat. They can, I've had some kids, depending on like how entrenched they are, they're able to see that, oh, okay, you know, I'm not really in the driver's seat. But what we do in the beginning of treatment sometimes is have them do a Venn diagram. So if you think about a Venn diagram, so like two circles, one circle is the person and one circle is going to be anorexia. And I ask them to draw it such that like, show me how much anorexia is overlapping on you. So if the person draws themselves and then draws like another circle completely covering them, that would mean like, there's none of them shining through, none of their wise mind, none of their like healthy choices. Like it's all eating disorder. And a lot of times in the first session, like, yeah, there's like a tiny sliver of them kind of poking through. And that is as close as I'll get to like them understanding exactly what you were saying, which is that I started this to maybe feel like I'm in control, but wow, look at that. Like, but you can help, you can use that as like a therapeutic tool to point it out like, wow, like you're really not in the driver's seat at all. Like it's all anorexia all the time. That must be exhausting. And then I also want to know, what do parents think? Like how much do parents think that their kid is covered by the illness? And does that differ? And then I do it again at the end of treatment to see, and it's so nice to see like how much space and distance they feel like they have. I had one kid be like, it's not even in the room anymore. Like I laugh when I think about it, but I've had other kids be like, it's here. Like I can see it. I know it's there. I know the situations that might make it more stressful, that might have it creeping back close, but it's not covering me at all. But it is really nice to look at those two things side by side and help them reflect on their journey and the progress and how tough it really has been, because it is a tough journey. Mm-hmm. I'm always so impressed by all the families and all the kids that go through it.
Can you tell us a little bit more about treatment, even just like treatment options, especially for, you know, it sounds like there's psychosocial and family interventions, but maybe give us a little bit of an example of a case or a typical case that you work with, just so people listening can kind of picture what it looks like for someone to get treatment. Because I'm sure it's really hard to treat, right?
It is. Yeah, it is really, it's really challenging. The two treatments that I'm trained in are family-based treatment, which I've been speaking a little bit about, where you have the whole family. It's comprised of three phases. Parents are in charge for phase one. Phase two is return of developmentally appropriate control back to the adolescent. So to help them practice eating normally again, while parents are kind of still supervising and monitoring. And then phase three is just talking about like other things. Like if we weren't talking about an eating disorder, what would we be talking about? Like relationships or getting your driver's license or applying to colleges and like normal adolescent things. And that's really just phasing out. And so it's a time limited treatment. It's usually somewhere between like 9 months and 18 sessions with the family. The other treatment that I know that has a book recently came out on it, also made by Jim Locke, is called adolescent focused therapy. And that's an individual treatment. And it does have some evidence backing its efficacy, but it's longer and it often incurs more hospitalization. So it's a more costly treatment, and that's because it's individual. So we meet with the adolescent one-on-one. There's a couple of parent collateral sessions, but we are trying to help the adolescent figure out the conceptualization of their eating disorder. So like what function is the eating disorder or the restrictive eating fulfilling? Like, and there's four different conceptualizations, and I'm going to try to remember them all right now. But one is like they're trying to stop development and stay a child, like suppress menses, suppress all of those things. Another is that it's how they're coping with depression and anxiety. It's like numbing it out. Another is it's their identity. They want an identity, and having this illness is their identity. And another one is managing anger. So if they're really angry at someone like parents or something like that, this is a way that they're trying to deal. This is the way they're trying to show people that they're angry. So we meet with them for several sessions, trying to help them collaboratively think of which conceptualization they best fall into. And then once we do that, it's like, all right, what can we do instead? What can we try doing instead? So it takes longer because you're waiting for the adolescent to figure out what works for them. And there's a lot of trial and error. And because of the nature of anorexia, oftentimes it's very slow. The adolescent really has to buy into it. But I have had one patient so far that's successfully gone through a course of AFT and has gotten much better. So that was very nice to see. It certainly was slower than FBT, but it was also really lovely to see them kind of flourish and develop and blossom the way that they did. But those are the two treatments that I've done.
That's awesome. Can you give it a description of what it looks like to, I mean, you kind of gave us nice endpoints of the Venn diagram, but what does it look like when someone goes from, you know, coming in and being very sick to getting better?
Yeah. Let me think of so generally for FBT, I think it's interesting because session one is like kind of setting the stage, talking about how we need to externalize the illness. So talking about it as anorexia, not their kid. Help parents be on the same page. So because they're going to be kind of the team that's doing this together. Talk about siblings and what their role is in treatment, which is usually going to be like, you know, the cheerleader. Like the kid is going to be pissed at their parents for this treatment. Like they're going to be pissed at me. They're going to be pissed at the parents. That's okay. That's fine. But they're going to need an ally. And so siblings are going to be the ones to be an ally. Siblings should not be in charge of like, have one more bite to their sibling. Like that's going to probably piss the sibling off, understandably. So the siblings are going to be the cheerleaders. So orienting everybody to the role. And then session two for that treatment is a family meal. So I watch them eat. And I don't eat, but I ask them. So their instructions are basically like, make a meal that is going to be something that you feel like is going to re-nourish your starving child. So if they come to me with like lettuce and grapes, I'm going to be angry and ask like, what went through your head when you were picking this meal? Something nicer than that, but I would wonder. And I ask the parents to make the decision together so they can start practicing being on the same page. And then back before COVID, they would come into my office and we'd set out a table and they would, I'd say, start serving each other. And I'd be asking questions while they were doing that. Like if the ill child is plating her own food, I'd want to know like, oh, like, is this how it's always been done? Do you feel like she's taking enough? And maybe gently recommend like, why don't mom or dad, why don't you decide how much she's getting? Things like that, like small minor adjustments that they can make. And I want it to be a challenging meal because I want to see anorexia come out during that meal. I want to see anorexia because I want to help give them strategies like sitting on either side of her, like sitting and being patient. And I also want to see what they're doing and what's working and what's not working. I think the sessions, I've now learned that the sessions where I feel the most nervous prognostically is when anorexia doesn't come out. So when the kid just comes in and eats everything quickly and it's like a good calorie dense meal, I'm worried. I don't know what's going to happen after the meal. We've lost the opportunity for learning. Parents haven't really learned anything in that session because I haven't been able to see anorexia and help give them some coaching strategies around what to do. And so I know that like Dr. LaGrange in UCSF told me that he used to have candy in his drawer in his office. So if the meal went super smooth, he'd throw out a couple candies and be like, have her eat this. What about dessert? Just to try to get anorexia to come to the table so that we can see. And so parents can have that opportunity for learning. And so I had a lovely family where the kid did great, ate everything, but I was super nervous knowing all of this. And so I had parents get her like more bacon and more bacon until anorexia did come out.
And what did that look like when the anorexia, like she just wouldn't eat it or
she got anger? Super upset. There was crying. There was like hair curtain in front of the face, like looking like from The Ring, like not touching the fork, not wanting to, you know, pushing away from the table. And so parents like sitting on either side of her, like picking up the fork, loading it with some bacon, putting it in her hand, mom tied her hair, like just like stepping in and doing all these little things and just sitting there and just being really patient and really and reminding her, like, we know anorexia is making this so hard. We're here for you. We got you. We're going to get through this together. We know you can do it. You have to eat. But the bottom line being, you have to eat. Like, you have to take another bite. And the goal for the family meal was really for the kid to have one more bite than what anorexia wanted them to have. And she was able to do that despite all of the all of the anger. So that was nice to see. And then the rest of phase one just kind of looks like parents continuing to use some of the strategies they learned in that meal and go through the rest of the meals and snacks that way. There is ongoing medical follow-up to make sure that they're medically stable for outpatient care. And I communicate really closely with their pediatricians or adolescent medicine doctors. And then at the very end of it, it should look like the kid starts from like, we have like 10 minutes with the adolescent alone in the beginning of these sessions. Usually my patients in phase one are like, don't really want to talk. They're kind of angry that they're in this. They don't want to be doing this. And then at the end, they're like, they're so much brighter. They're so much happier. They want to engage. They want to talk about other things. They want to talk about like, oh, like I had this math test, or, oh, this person said this at school. And they look more like an adolescent. They look more like a happy teenager. And it's really a joy to see when they get to that point.
How do you, how do you make someone eat? Like how, if someone's just absolutely resistant, I remember talking to someone whose sister had anorexia, and she was just talking about like the deterioration of the relationship between her sister and her father, because her father was always being like, you've got to eat, come on, like eat. It was just struggle sessions every single night. And then, you know, their relationship deteriorated. And so then how could he help at all? Like, how do you prevent getting into that?
Yeah, I think, families that are going through, when the parents are really supporting it, I have to remind them that it's going to get uglier before it starts to look better. Like, it's going to feel like it's getting worse, but that means you're doing the right thing. So when the kid's getting loud and angry, that means that anorexia is being challenged. And the kid's being compliant, that might mean that you're not giving foods that are really going to get their weight back up. And I think, you know, from my experience and what the evidence shows is that like that first phase one is going to feel like the kid is miserable as their weight's slowly climbing up, but it does get better. It does, as the kids, because when somebody is that malnourished too, like cognitively, they're having so many deficits. They're not like, they're an adolescent first and foremost, so their frontal lobe is not developed, but then also like they're just totally starving and malnourished all the time. So they're not in the right capacity to make these kinds of decisions. And so as they start to get renourished and their brain starts to grow back in the way that it needs to be growing back, and they lose some of that anorexia fog, I have seen relationships that look really, really poor in phase one start to repair and start to get better. Yeah.
Okay. So if you're a parent, I mean, would you try these things before seeking treatment? Like, would you try portioning out the food, sitting on another side of the kid?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think one thing that we're realizing through the pandemic is that all the clinicians are full. Like, we're all at capacity and there's so many wait lists. So one of the things that Stanford is looking at is like a guided self-help platform. So kind of the things that I'm talking to you guys about delivered in videos, like can parents watch these videos and then learn these strategies and be able to do it on their own? Do they actually need like weekly therapy? And so there's currently, we're looking at pilot data for whether we compared people who got this like guided self-help thing where they're trying the strategies, just like you said, versus like standard FBT to see how they compare. We don't know yet, so stay tuned. But, and then hopefully to be able to give that, if it seems like it's working just as well, like disseminate that guided self-help platform for all these families who are kind of catching their kids in the early stages and can just watch these videos and be like, oh, okay, cool. Like I can do some of this on my own. Cause I think sometimes parents just don't know. They don't know that they can, they feel like they need to be given permission to like take control, go forth and take control over your child's eating. And then once they do, they can turn it around pretty quickly. Sometimes not, but I've seen it happen. So that's hopeful for sure.
So what would the tips be?
Yeah. Like if you know, for people who, let's say, don't have access to treatment now, or they're just listening and they just want to help right away before they could find a therapist, like what would you tell people?
I would say to, if you're worried about the kid and their weight, make sure you're going to regular medical appointments, either with a pediatrician or with like somebody who is a medical doctor that has experience working with teens with eating disorders. There are vital sign checks that need to be done. So blood pressure and heart rate are two of the biggest indicators that a body is not, you know, nourished enough. And so getting the heart rate checked, getting orthostatic blood pressure changes checked, keeping an eye on the weight. So weekly, I don't recommend doing it every single day because there's just so many things that impact weight, like whether you've pooped or had breakfast or something. Like, so weekly weights just to make sure that it's not downtrending. I do like to remind parents that, like, there should be no point in adolescence, unless recommended by your doctor, that an adolescent should be losing weight, right? Because from the time that you're 12 to, like, mid-20s, you put on a gallon of blood. A gallon is a lot. If you ever pick up a gallon of milk, that's a lot. That's heavy. Like, that needs to be coming on. Your bones are getting denser and stronger. Your brain's getting bigger. Your kidneys go from being, like, the size of this to, like, the size of my fist, which I'm realizing this is a podcast now. No one can see that. But they should go to the size of your fist. So there's a lot of things that happen in an adolescent's body that mean that weight needs to be moving up. So getting the weight checked. So from a medical and vital standpoint, getting all those things covered. And then in the meantime, depending on the level of concern, plating the child's food. If the child suddenly decides they want to go vegetarian or vegan and parents worried about a downtrending weight, no. Like, maybe when the weight's healthy and stable, you can say no. You can say, you know, I totally appreciate your desire to support environmental and animal rights. Why don't we donate to this thing? Or why don't we find another way to do that that's not impacting food or your intake? If parents are noticing that they're making a whole separate meal for their one kid because of some dietary restraints that are sudden and not, like, because of lactose intolerance or whatever, think twice about why that's happening. I think that a lot of times it is totally fine, but if parents want to, like, if they know that their kid has an eating disorder, if they've been diagnosed, then starting to take control over the eating, starting to supervise meals, like having more family meals, like, together, so that you can see what the kid's eating, so that the kid's not just disappearing into their room with a plate and you don't really know what they're eating or if they're finishing. Those are some of the places I would recommend parents start, if that makes sense.
Those are awesome tips. That was
super
helpful. Yeah.
No, that's great. I was wondering if you have any last tips or resources, books, or anything that you feel like, I mean, we'll post whatever you sent us on the website, but I was wondering if there's anything that parents or loved ones can look into.
Yeah. For FBT, there is a book called Help Your Teenager Beat an Eating Disorder by my boss at Stanford, which is fantastic. I know Dr. Zucker at Duke also wrote something called Off the Cuff, and I think it's for parents. I think these are both available on Amazon. And there's also a lot of just good resources, like, online. NIDA is a great resource for people interested in learning more about an eating disorder, especially all the different kinds of eating disorders. And they have a lot of information on body image, warning signs and symptoms, what eating disorders are, and where, like, different preventative methods. And I can definitely send you several more that I think could be helpful, both from a medical standpoint and from a behavioral and psychological standpoint.
Perfect. I could have asked, like, 200 more questions. Nani, this was great. Thanks so much for coming on.
Of course. Yeah. I'm happy to be here. These are great questions. They made me think too. They're hard questions.
Well, thanks so much for coming on, Nandini. We'll talk soon.
All right. Bye.
By accessing this podcast, I acknowledge that the hosts of this podcast make no warranty, guarantee, or representation as to the accuracy or sufficiency of the information featured in this podcast. The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in this podcast are for general information only, and any reliance on the information provided in this podcast is done at your own risk. This podcast and any and all content or services available on or through this podcast are provided for general, non-commercial informational purposes only and do not constitute the practice of medical or any other professional judgment, advice, diagnosis, or treatment and should not be considered or used as a substitute for the independent professional judgment, advice, diagnosis, or treatment of a duly licensed and qualified healthcare provider. In case of a medical emergency, you should immediately call 911. The hosts do not endorse, approve, recommend, or certify any information, product, process, service, or organization presented or mentioned in this podcast, and information from this podcast should not be referenced in any way to imply such approval or endorsement.